she asked. "It's not at all complicated," he said. "In fact, it's a simple matter. If you would like to visit your son in enemy territory, we would ask only that, while you are there, you arrange to meet up with your young friend Michael Hinzer. The two of you could go for a stroll, for instance, in the grounds of Charlottenburg Castle." She was confused, and then he said, "You can leave the rest to us."
"You can leave the rest to us," she cries. Then he added, "One good turn deserves another. One good turn deserves another."
Her tone is a mixture of horror and triumph. I am clearly missing something here. I wonder whether in German there is a Stickelbrick noun for this strange combined emotion. "At that moment," she explains, "Karl Wilhelm Fricke shot through my head. I had heard him years before on the radio from the West tell of his kidnapping and imprisonment, and I'd never forgotten it. In a flash, I knew. They were going to use me as bait in a trap to kidnap Michael." Karl Wilhelm Fricke is well known in Germany as a broadcaster and journalist, and as a phenomenon, the case of Fricke. He has always been an agitator against the German Democratic Republic. On April Fool's Day 1955, at a meeting in West Berlin, Stasi agents drugged his cognac and then shunted him, unconscious, over the sector border. He was convicted of war and boycott instigation against the GDR, and sentenced to 4 years in solitary confinement, which he served until the last day. There was nothing the West could do to get him out. When he was released into West Berlin, he immediately, and at some risk to himself, broadcast over the airwaves the story of his abduction. At the end of an afternoon spent with him, he said to me, "Frau Pohl, then Ruhrdanz, is a very brave woman." Frau Pohl knew Michael would trust her to come to a meeting in the park, and when they came to bundle him into a vehicle, she would have to turn her back and walk away. She doesn't know whether the offer would have meant more than one visit to Torsten or staying out of prison. She knew only that if she accepted, they would have her then, her soul bought with a visit to her critically ill son. She would be theirs forever, a stool pigeon and a tame little rat.
Me, bait in a trap for Michael! And of course that was an absolute no. I couldn't.
Her back is straight, and her hands are clenched into fists on her thighs.
"Karl Wilhelm Fricke," she says, "was my guardian angel."
She starts to crumble and break. At this moment she does not look like a woman who was saved from anything.
"I had to decide against my son, but I couldn't let myself be used in this way."
Her back slumps, and she is crying again. She holds one hand in the other, and from time to time swaps them around, as if to give herself some kind of comfort.
"At that time, it was the right decision," she says through tears. "And even later, too, I could always say to myself, I did not make myself guilty. I can sleep at night with what I have done."
She doesn't try to cover her face. There was no right answer here, no good outcome.
"It is true that I didn't burden myself with this on my conscience, but I did," she draws in breath in a spasm of pain, "decide against my son."
It is so hard to know what kind of mortgage our acts put on our future. Frau Pohl had the courage to do the right thing by her conscience in a situation where most people would decide to see their baby and tell themselves later they had no choice. Once made, though, her decision took a whole new fund of courage to live with. It seems to me that Frau Pohl, as one does, may have overestimated her own strength, her resistance to damage, and that she is now, for her principles, a lonely, teary, guilt-racked wreck.
"The result of this was that I was never interrogated again."
She learnt that her husband and the three students had also been arrested, as well as some 30 others from all over the GDR who had been planning to leave through the tunnel. Chapter 23.
Hohenschönhausen. Frau Paul and her husband were held at Hohenschönhausen prison for 5 months, and then, along with the 3 students, transported to Rostock on the Baltic Sea coast for trial. Frau Paul thinks this was because the Western media knew of the plight of Torsten on one side of the wall and of his parents on the other, and the authorities wanted to make sure there was no chance of publicity. The couple never saw the charges against them, nor the judgment. They were offered the services of Dr. Vogel, the lawyer with close government connections who became famous for negotiating the trade in people between East and West. But they mistrusted the arrangement and turned it down, insisting on their own family solicitor. He couldn't do much to help them, though, because he was handed the charges against his clients only 5 minutes before the trial began. The prosecutor alleged,
"Rodin's Sigrid is accused of inducing or, at the least, aiding and abetting citizens of the German Democratic Republic to illegally leave the GDR. The accused maintains connections with members of a West Berlin people smuggling and terrorist organization which lures people out of the GDR and facilitates their illegal leaving of the GDR either with illegal papers or through the violation of the national border. She had custody of forged passports in her flat, organized meetings and conveyed information about planned people smuggling operations, and accommodated persons to be smuggled in her flat. There exists the urgent suspicion that she herself will illegally leave the GDR.
Frau Paul reads this to me and maintains at each point her innocence. "We'd long since, as I told you, given up trying to get out," she says, "and I did not know what the students were doing at our flat." In 1992, 29 years after the trial, Frau Paul saw in her file the judgment for the first time. There was no mention of Torsten. The judges wrote that her attitude of rejection towards our state had been exacerbated through the fact that the accused has been a constant listener to NATO smear radio. They put that in about the NATO smear radio because I would not let myself be misused as bait in their trap. Frau Paul and her husband were each given 4 years hard labor. She was put in a paddy wagon and taken from Rostock back to Hohenschönhausen to serve her time. Werner Koch got a lesser sentence, 1 year and 9 months in ordinary prison, because the penalties for being an accessory to the attempt to flee the country were greater than the crime of trying to flee itself. Hohenschönhausen prison is not far from the center of East Berlin, but its existence was unknown even to people in neighboring suburbs. Every street that leads in or out of the area around it was blocked off by a boom gate and a sentry. Hohenschönhausen was a prison for political prisoners. It was the innermost security installation in a secured area within a walled-off country. It was another blank on the map. Frau Paul took me there one day. It was an ordinarily cold day, and we were in an ordinarily grey residential street. As we walked along, she nodded and said, "That's where the boom gates were." All that remained was a hip-height bollard on the pavement. We passed it into what had been the secure Stasi zone. "That building there was Department M, postal surveillance," Frau Paul said, walking slightly ahead of me and pointing with an open hand. "That one over there was the forgery workshop for the Stasi. That one was a special Stasi hospital." These were plain concrete buildings. They looked empty. "Those high-rises over there are Stasi housing," she continued. I followed her hand and saw a cluster of grey and white multi-story towers. From one of them emerged a middle-aged man with a dachshund on a retractable lead. The man ignored us, but the dog eyed me warily as it pissed on the curb. Further inside the zone, we reached a building with high concrete walls topped by barbed wire. The walls seemed to stretch on and on, enclosing an area as big as a city block. At the corners were octagonal guard towers, and underneath them, along the outside, an empty dog run. Hohenschönhausen has been closed for several years. People are now fighting to preserve it as a museum of the regime. Frau Paul is involved with them, and she has a key. We approach the towering grey steel entry gates. There was a man-sized door next to them. Her eyes were clear. Her clothes made the rustle of nylon. She moved ahead of me in a businesslike way that said, "I hate this place, but I'm still here." We slipped into the empty prison, into a huge yard surrounded by buildings, with another squat building in the center. The ground was asphalt and gravel, cracking like the top of a cake. A truck was parked in the yard. It was painted gray and had a solid steel cage on the back with no windows or apparent ventilation of any kind. "This is the same as the paddy wagon I was transported in for 5 hours from Rostock," she said. And then, to my surprise, she added, "Get in." I did. Inside, instead of 2 benches for the prisoners as I had expected, it had a tiny corridor and 6 internal cells, each with a lockable door. These were not big enough to stand upright in, and contained only a crossboard to sit on. She followed me into the truck. "Get in," she said again, pointing at the furthest tiny cell. "It'll give you a feel for what it was like." I climbed into one and she closed the heavy steel door. The key turned in the lock. I sat on the bench and everything was pitch black and horrible. Outside the door, she said loudly, "You have to imagine that someone is sitting here with a machine gun." I imagined it. Then she let me out. Later, I learned that these trucks were sometimes disguised as linen service vehicles or refrigerated fish transports or baker's vans, when all the time they were ferrying prisoners and dissidents at gunpoint around the Republic. We walked across the yard to the building in the middle and entered it via a truck bay with giant doors. "This is where I was brought," she said. I had no idea where I was. For all I knew, I could have been taken from Rostock to any place in the GDR. I certainly didn't know I was right in the heart of Berlin. The paddy wagon and the truck bay were designed so that the prisoners could be let out one at a time and never see each other, or daylight, or a street, or the entrance to the building. We walked up the steps. A huge studded metal door slid sideways to reveal a long linoleum corridor. Frau Paul pointed out a primitive cable and hook system that ran along the walls at head height. When a new prisoner was coming, it operated as an alarm system, turning on red lights at intervals. That was the signal for all other prisoners to be locked in their cells and guards to be out of sight. The prisoner was not to know who else was here or have any human contact which was not strictly monitored, for psychological purposes, by her captors. We walked along the corridor. Some of the cells were open, some shut. The only sound was our footfalls on the floor. Grey paint peeled off the walls. It was not the first time Frau Paul has been back, but I don't imagine this is easy for her. I know there are places that I don't visit, some even that I prefer not to drive past, where bad things have happened. But here she is in the place that broke her, and she is telling me about it. It is part bravery, like the bravery that made her refuse the Stasi deal, and it is part, perhaps, obsession, caused by what they did to her after that. She took me to the room where she was interrogated. In this complex, 120 rooms were available for simultaneous interrogations. Hers had brown patterned wallpaper reaching halfway up the walls, a dun-coloured linoleum floor, and a large desk and chair. Behind the door was a small, four-legged stool like a milking stool. 22 hours on that," Frau Paul said. Then we went to another building, the U-boat. From the ground it looked ordinary enough. We entered down some steps. Frau Paul was telling me it had been purpose-built by the Russians in 1946 as a series of torture chambers. I was sort of listening, but mainly I was adjusting to the strange smell. Some smells are hard to unravel. I remember the university library around exam time. It smelt of sweat and damp coats and bad breath. It was a mongrel smell, but it was the smell of pure fear. This U-boat smelt of damp and old urine and vomit and earth. The smell of misery. The tunnel corridor was long and stark. Single bulbs hung on cords. Frau Paul started opening doors. First, a compartment so small a person could only stand. It was designed to be filled with icy water up to the neck. There were 68 of these, she told me. Then there were concrete cells with nothing in them, where prisoners would be kept in the dark amid their own excrement. There was a cell lined entirely with padded black rubber. Frau Paul was held nearby. She remembers hearing the prisoner inside the rubber cell gradually lose his mind. At the end, the only words he had left were, "Never get out." Once, when he was taken away, she was ordered in to mop up his vomit and blood. The strangest cell contained a wooden yoke arrangement, something like an apparatus at a county fair. The prisoner would be nearly bent double, head and hands through the slots and the yoke closed over them. In front of his head hung a metal bucket of water, like a nose bag. The floor and walls were black and lined with spiky ridges. Frau Paul explained that the prisoner would be barefoot, yoked into position. The ridges would bite into the soles of his feet. Then water dripped from a pipe hanging through the ceiling onto his head. Eventually the prisoner would be in such pain that he would lose consciousness and his head would slump. It would hit the water in the bucket in front of him, and he would either revive into pain again or drown. There was nothing funny about this cell, and there was nothing funny about standing in it with Frau Paul, feeling the spiky floor through my boots and touching the coarse yoke and imagining being bent nearly double in the dark, in pain and drifting between consciousness and drowning. But there was something barnyard about it. It seemed too primitive for the mid-20th century, and too primitive for here. This contraption belonged further east and further back in time, some Pythonesque sideshow of history. Though somehow there was something even more chilling about the office with the little stool Frau Paul was made to sit on, and the ordinary administrative desk and chair where the interrogator sat over her. It was in offices that the Stasi truly came into their own, as innovators, story-makers, and Faustian bargain-hunters. That room was where a deal was offered and refused, and a soul buckled out of shape forever. Not one of the torturers at Hohenschönhausen has been brought to justice. 4 times a year, Frau Paul received permission to have a visitor, mostly her mother, but she'd be transported elsewhere for it, so that neither she nor her visitor would know where in the GDR she was being kept. Mail was sent to another Stasi address and brought to her opened. She had been taken out of time and out of place. Torsten remained over the years at the West End Hospital. The nurses and doctors fed him through tubes and gave him medicine and changed his nappies. They sang him songs, they taught him to speak, and they tried to teach him to walk. The hospital was the only home, and its staff the only people Torsten Ruhrdanz knew. This is one of the letters that got through to his parents. It was written in November 1963, when Torsten was nearly 3 years old. "Dear Mr. and Mrs. Ruhrdanz, I learnt that you would like to be informed as to Torsten's health, which I can very well understand. Generally he is cheerful, making progress with his walking, and happy. He has become the darling of the ward. Of course, from time to time, we still have difficulties to overcome, which means that, unfortunately, discharge from hospital is not possible in the foreseeable future. We cannot manage to feed him without a stomach tube, because as soon as he eats normally, he is in pain. His weight is still unsatisfactory, at 7,670 grams. His height is also significantly less than the norm for his age. His diarrhea has virtually ceased, though. There is nothing left for us but to continue as we have been, and in the hope that his stomach will gradually widen and that the problems at the end of his diaphragm will mend. You can be assured that everything possible will continue to be done for your child. I will write again before Christmas. Yours sincerely, Professor Dr. L. Michael Hinzer has always lived in the West. He was never kidnapped by the Stasi. He didn't even know that they were after him. And until recently, he had no idea that Frau Paul was in any way connected with his continuing freedom. I found out about it a couple of years ago, after the wall fell. For years I'd heard nothing from the Ruhrdanzes. Then they called me, he says. All this story with the blackmailing and the plans to kidnap me, I knew nothing about that at all. He is slightly uncomfortable with the whole idea. I mean, I always saw myself as small fry. I just put people together, got passports. I knew it was illegal under GDR law, but... He trails off. He didn't really think it through. Even if he had, how could he have imagined that someone else was being asked to pay a price for his liberty? She's a very courageous woman, Hinzer continues. I have a great deal of respect for her. I'm also grateful to her. But at the same time, I don't think I need to feel guilty. I don't feel guilty. I mean, I was just lucky that I didn't fall into the clutches of a Stasi. That way, or by other means. He thinks that if they had really wanted him, they could have got him. And this is probably true. She was very active in the whole thing, Hinzer says admiringly. The Ruhrdanzes used to marshal the people from Halle or Dresden or wherever who wanted to get out and help them. They were very committed people. Frau Paul has told me none of this, although it might be something another person would be proud of. The picture we make of ourselves, with all its congruences and fantastical edges, sustains us. Frau Paul does not picture herself as a hero or a dissident. She is a dental technician and a mother with a terrible family history. And she is a criminal. This seems to me the sorriest thing, that the picture she has of herself is one that the Stasi made for her. I told her that her story moved me deeply, Hinzer says, and that I don't know many people who would not have betrayed me. I said that there are not many people who have the courage she did, to behave with... He's looking for a way to describe it. With such great humanity, can I say? She behaved with such great humanity. We are both silent for a moment, but unfortunately, he says, at her cost. In August 1964, the Ruhrdanzes were bought free for 40,000 Western marks. But instead of being released into the West to be with their baby, they were dumped on the street in East Berlin with no papers. Frau Paul puts this down to their refusal of Dr. Vogel as lawyer. Of the estimated 34,000 people bought free between 1963 and 1989, there are, at this stage, only 9 documented cases of such cruelty, where the West paid hard currency and the East did not deliver the people whose freedom had been purchased. Torsten was still living in the West End hospital. On the 9th of April 1965, when he was 4 years old, Frau Paul had news of him from Sister Gisela, one of the nurses. "We all wish you and your husband a very healthy and happy Easter. Torsten has painted you an Easter picture all by himself, brown Easter bunnies and a nest with colourful eggs. He said, 'That is for my mummy. She'll like that.' Yesterday we received your lovely card, and we thank you on behalf of Torsten. He was so happy, and we had to read it out to him straight away. He never lets it out of his little hands and keeps looking at the Sandman on it. My dear Mrs. Ruhrdanz, Torsten is really coming along now. It is such a shame that you can't be here to enjoy his progress. It could drive one to despair, this drama between parts of a single city. But I don't want to write about that. Better some more news of Torsten. He weighs 9,450 grams now and is 84 centimeters tall. He speaks and understands everything like a 6-year-old. He doesn't miss a trick. He told me I should write you that he's coming home soon to Karlsdorf. Torsten can walk 5 meters by himself.
Apart from that, he wheels around all afternoon about the station. Dear Mrs. Roerdans, every best wish from us and 1,000 kisses from Torsten. For his daddy, too. They waited another 8 months before Torsten was well enough to be released from the West End Hospital. When he came home to East Germany, he was nearly 5, small and bent and very polite. "Of course he didn't recognize me as his mother," Frau Paul says. "He didn't know what a mother was. He only knew the sterile atmosphere of the hospital and the staff there, the doctors, the sisters, and the other personnel, even though they all dealt very lovingly with him, and they tried—" she's crying now, hard— "tried to create for him, in whatever ways they could, something like a family atmosphere. It just wasn't his home. He was frightened, and when I—" she has to stop because she can't get the words out. "And when I took him in my arms for the first time and held him to me, he must have thought, 'What does this old lady want with me? She says she is my mother, but what is that? A mother?' He addressed us with the formal Sie. He would say, 'Mother, would you kindly be able to make me a sandwich? I'm hungry.' Or, 'Father, would you mind lifting me onto the chair? I can't manage.' And this terrible distance. They made our boy a stranger to us." She lowers her voice. "And it was then I fought with myself the most. Did I decide right in the interrogation when I refused to be used as bait for a kidnapping? Or should I have come to my son?" She is weeping and weeping. I am upset, too. It's the small things that make you cry. The idea of nurses and doctors in West Berlin trying to tell a little boy what a family was, to prepare him for one. The idea that in justifying her decision of more than 30 years ago to me here today, there is no peace for Frau Paul. I am scrabbling for tissues which seem to exist only in various embarrassing degrees of decay in the bottom of my backpack. I don't even think about Torsten. The doorbell sounds, and Frau Paul gets up to answer it. She comes back into the room with a man whose age is hard to tell, but I know immediately it's him. When I stand up to shake hands, I tower over him, and his hand fits inside mine. His body is small and hunched, and his arms and legs seem crooked, spidery. His head seems small, too. He has bright, deep-set dark eyes and prominent cheekbones. He's wearing a jacket with a couple of badges on the lapel, casual cool. "Pleased to meet you," Torsten says genially, and he sinks down lopsided into the couch next to me. He does not seem surprised to see his mother has been crying. Torsten is not sure whether he remembers meeting his parents for the first time. "I've seen the photos," he says, "and it's hard to distinguish what I remember from what I've since seen. I know from being told that I addressed them with the formal Sie, because I didn't know what a parent was. Sometimes I have an inkling of the meeting, in the dark past, like a Fata Morgana, but not consciously so, no." His voice is very soft. I want to know if he thinks his mother made the right decision not to come to him, so I ask him directly. He is relaxed. "I have never looked at my parents and thought they made the wrong decision," he says, "or looked at them like the Stasi did, as criminals or anything like that. Quite the opposite. I admire them for what they did." He seems to have learned to contain both longing and regret. "It doesn't occur to me," he says, "to think that perhaps they might have done things differently and things might have worked out differently. But then again," I offer, "I suppose one visit wouldn't have made much difference." I wasn't trying to take any of her heroism away. I was trying to find a way of thinking about her choice that wasn't such a drastic abandonment of him. But he gently cuts me off and thinks of it from his mother's point of view. "Well, yes," he says, "but if you think someone is dying, you probably want to see them just one more time before they do. That would make a difference to you, even if it doesn't change anything."
Torsten supplements his invalid pension by working with bands in the electronic music scene. It is something he has done in one form or another since before the wall fell. Back then, because of his invalid status, he was permitted to travel to the West once a fortnight. He would be commissioned by rock musicians in the GDR to smuggle back spare parts for them. Torsten was well known to the border guards and was searched about 90% of the time, he says, smiling. I was frequently caught, but luckily the consequences weren't so bad for me. They did accuse me, though, of dangerous trade with musical instruments and musical electronics, he laughs. Despite his family history, the Stasi went after Torsten to see if he would inform for them. First, they gathered compromising material on his smuggling. Then they brought him in for questioning. But Torsten went mum, so the same material that would have been used to pressure him into informing became instead evidence of his unsuitability for it. A final report of the 17th of June 1985 is two sentences long. R is not suited for an unofficial collaboration with the ministry. R participates in criminal activity. It was clearly not an option to write. R refuses on principle to collaborate. I ask Torsten whether he thinks of his life as having been shaped by the wall. I find it hard to tell exactly in what sense my life has been shaped by the wall, how it might have been different otherwise, he says, but that it has been, I have no doubt. He has learnt not to play the if-only game. If only there had been no wall, I might have not relapsed. I might have grown up with my parents. They might not have gone to prison. I might have had a healthy body, a job, a partner. He shifts in his seat to look at me straight on. There are no people who are whole, he says. Everyone has issues of their own to deal with. Mine might be a little harder, but the main thing is how one deals with them. And how do you? I am facing him, looking at his twisted body and listening to him breathe through the tubes they placed inside him. Well, it is an issue for me. I think life can end much too quickly, so I have no long-term aspirations. Whatever it is I want it now, to experience it today. I have no patience for saving money or building up some kind of enterprise. It makes me nervous. Other people say, you have time, you're still relatively young, but I'm always so afraid that things can come to an end at any time. He pauses. Or that politically, too, it could all change again, and then I'd have no chance to experience certain things. I remark that for something so big that shaped their lives so brutally, it's hard now to find a trace of the wall. I'm about to say I think it's odd to let everyone forget so quickly when Torsten says, I'm happy that it's gone, and I'm happy too that there's so little of it left to see. It would remind me that it could come back, that everything that's happened might be reversed. But that wouldn't be possible, I laugh. He looks at me soberly. But anything is possible, he says. One can never say that something is not possible. His mother agrees. Who would have thought that a wall could be built? She says. That was also impossible. And who would have thought that at the end that it might ever fall? That was also impossible. People here talk of the Mauer im Kopf, or the wall in the head. I thought this was just a shorthand way of referring to how Germans define themselves still as Easterners and Westerners. But I see now a more literal meaning. The wall and what it stood for do still exist. The wall persists in Stasi men's minds as something they hope might one day come again, and in their victims' minds, too, as a terrifying possibility. Torsten offers to give me a lift to the station. Frau Paul kisses him and takes my hand with both of hers. Then she shrugs her shoulders. That's it, she says, as though when she added up the parts of her life, it was a smallish thing. Torsten's car is an old-style BMW with a high seat custom-built behind the steering wheel. He puts on some music with a Latin beat, and it keeps strange syncopated time with the windscreen wipers. We chat and he takes me past the station, nearly all the way to Alexanderplatz. Then he lets me out with a wave and drives on, crooked and crippled, and living for the day. Chapter 24. Herr Bonsack. I walk around to pick up my last Stasi man. In his street, new tram lines are being laid. Lengths of steel are strewn like licorice down the median strip. It's lunchtime and the workers are nowhere to be seen. I ring the buzzer where it says Bonsack. A man comes out putting on a smart tan overcoat. He's tall and slightly stooped, thick-set through the chest. His face is pleasant, with receding hair and full cheeks. He looks me straight in the eye and smiles a warm smile.
"Let's go to my local," he says.
The pub is a traditional Berlin Kneipe. It has a bar in dark wood with mirrors behind it, booth seats and lacy white curtains to shield people from the street. A shaft of light slips past them on an angle, slow afternoon light of lazy particles and beams. Two regulars watch their glasses. There are little pubs like this in both East and West Berlin, where everyone knows everyone else. I've occasionally walked in for directions or cigarettes, and each time I felt I had walked into someone's living room uninvited. When a stranger enters, the hum of conversation breaks while people look up and hunch their shoulders. Here, though, when the regulars see Herr Bonsack, they nod. The publican smiles like a brother.
"How are we?"
he asks, rubbing his hands together.
"What'll it be today, then?"
"We might go into the side room," Herr Bonsack says. "If that's all right, for a chat."
"Of course, of course."
He shuffles out from behind the bar in his socks and slippers and shows us in. There are old advertisements for beer on the walls, pictures of glowing-cheeked maidens and horses and hops. I look at Herr Bonsack. In the light from the windows at his back, he seems to have a bit of a glow about him, too.
"What can I get for the lady and the gentleman?"
"I'll have a wheat beer and a corn," he says. "And you?"
It's early. I order a beer and forego the schnapps. Günther Bonsack's voice is deep and slightly slurred, like a person with ill-fitting crowns or a man who has been drinking. His eyes are bright and he is relaxed with me. He is not, as it turns out, a man with anything to prove. He is 57 years old and the only Stasi man I have ever met who outed himself. A lieutenant colonel, he worked in one of the most secret divisions of the Overseas Spy Service. The Hauptverwaltung Aufklärung, HVA. Herr Bonsack was in Division X, responsible, as he put it on the phone to me, for disinformation and psychological warfare against the West. The HVA was the Overseas Espionage Service of the Stasi. Its director, Marcus Wolf, the son of a Jewish doctor and playwright, is intelligent and urbane, and was the model, apparently, for John le Carré's spymaster, Carla. Wolf's HVA was subject to its minister, Milke, but Wolf and his men always saw themselves as a breed apart. Although they were organized according to military rank like the rest of the firm, they wore suits instead of uniforms, were highly educated, and enjoyed a privileged existence.
"Because we were responsible for the West," Herr Bonsack explained to me, "we could travel, and we were quite different. Our diplomats could speak languages and were cultivated. We all scorned Milke. We had our Wolf, the tall, slim, elegant intellectual."
Herr Bonsack trained as a journalist and worked for 26 years in disinformation. Much of Division X's work was directed against West Germany. It collected sensitive or secret information from agents in the West and leaked it to cause harm. It manufactured documents and spliced together recordings of conversations that never took place in order to damage persons in the public sphere. And it spread rumors about people in the West, including the devastating rumor that someone worked for them. Division X men fed coups to Western journalists about the Nazi past of West German politicians. Several major figures were brought down this way. It funded left-wing publications, and it managed, at least in one instance, to exert an extraordinary influence over the political process in West Germany itself. In 1972, the Social Democrat head of the West German government, Willy Brandt, faced a vote of no confidence in Parliament. Division X bribed one and possibly two backbenchers for their votes in order to keep him in power. Colonel Rolf Wagenbreth, the head of Division X, described its work simply as an attempt to turn the wheels of history. Herr Bonsack starts with a joke. He told it at lunch back in 1980 to a group of his colleagues at the restaurant reserved for the highest ranks of the Stasi. He leans back and smiles like an uncle with a secret.
The USA, the Soviet Union, and the GDR want to raise the Titanic, he says, lifting his eyebrows. The USA wants the jewels presumed to be in the safe.
He nods.
The Soviets are after the state-of-the-art technology. And the GDR...
He downs his corn for dramatic pause.
The GDR wants the band that played as it went down.
We laugh. Was it normal to tell jokes like that? I ask.
Yes, yes, he says. Quite normal. But it depended who was there. As soon as I told that one, I thought, oh, brother, that was a bit foolish of me because there was a general at the table.
He runs a hand over his head.
After lunch, the general took me aside and said in a quiet voice, next time, Bonsack, I wouldn't tell a joke like that. And that was way back in 1980. They were sensitive about the whole thing going down, even then.
Were there Milka jokes?
Yes, lots, he says. But the worst Milka ones weren't jokes. They were true.
Herr Bonsack was invited to the party the Stasi threw for themselves and their Russian comrades to celebrate the 40 years of the GDR. It was the 3rd of October 1989, the height of the demonstrations and unrest.
There were about 2,000 people at the party, he says. Milka made his entrance.
He raises one arm behind his ear and does a two-fingered walk through the air.
Down some stairs in the corner, surrounded by his generals. Like a ghost or the god in the machine.
Milka made a speech.
For 4 hours he spoke on and on. Every now and then he gave a rallying cry. And just remember, comrades, this one thing, the most important thing you have, is power. Hang on to power at all costs. Without it, you are nothing. He didn't mention the democracy demonstrations and the fact that the Soviets were backing away from us, Herr Bonsack says. But it was clear he must, at some level, have felt the end coming.
When Milka finally finished, there was a banquet. There were grapes and chicken drumsticks and melon and stone fruits.
Things that we never had in the GDR and that were truly exquisite, amazing delicacies to us.
But just as they were about to tuck in, Milka would quickly pick up the microphone to say a few more idiotic words, and everyone would have to put their drumsticks and bunches of grapes back down on their plates until he was done. He would finish up by saying,
Guten Appetit!
And the men would start to eat. But moments later, he'd grab the microphone again, and they would have to put it all down once more.
It went on and on, Herr Bonsack says. The whole occasion was insane.
At Christmas 1989, from his telling of it, events bloomed into full-scale, fast-forward farce. Herr Bonsack's entire division was ordered to stay at home so as not to provoke the demonstrators, and to be near the phone. At 3 a.m. they would receive a call ordering them to drive to Normannenstrasse, parking some way away so the demonstrators wouldn't know the buildings were occupied, and to enter by a rear door. When they reached their offices, all the lights would be out. They were ordered to don camouflage combat gear,
like the Foreign Legion in the jungle,
and then to kit themselves out with cooking equipment and cutlery, a spade, a protective suit in the event of chemical warfare, a blanket, toothpaste and brush, and ammunition. They were each issued with a pistol and a machine gun. The whole operation was timed. "What would you do then?" I ask.
We lie down on our desks and sleep. The generals upstairs on the 9th floor were simulating a war situation. One would come down and wake us up with a message. Say, an American sub had been sighted off Turkey, or the American B-52s are on standby. Then, at 5 a.m, we'd get worse news. Maybe that a Russian sub had been taken off Norway. They were pretending World War III had broken out.
What could you do?
Nothing. We slept some more.
At 7 a.m, they would get an order to go into the field.
We'd play war for a day, stand around and shoot the cardboard figures that popped up out of the grass. Everyone was there, highly intelligent specialists who could speak Arabic and goodness knows what, and we were all reduced to playing soldiers.
By the end of 1989, they were doing this every single week.
And we knew the GDR was lost, he says, so it was a circus.
Herr Bonsack's greatest fear was that he and the others would be ordered to shoot the demonstrators outside their building. During the exercises, they were told that the enemy had infiltrated the country and was inciting the East Germans against them. At the end, Milke was more direct. He told them that they, he meant the people, were the enemy. He said, "It's them or us."
"For me," Bonsack says, "that was the most terrifying thing. That instead of shooting cardboard figures, we'd have to shoot our own people. And we knew, just like under Hitler, that if we refused, we'd be taken off and shot ourselves."
There was another fear, too. Milke had also told his men, "If we lose, they'll string us all up." The atmosphere was hysterical. Herr Bonsack had been Marcus Wolff's contact man between the Stasi and the secret services in Hungary, Moscow, Prague and Warsaw.
Our man in Budapest had told me that in the drama of 56, his people were hanged in the trees outside their offices. He said to me, "If someone points you out, 5 minutes later you'll be swinging."
Herr Bonsack runs his hand over his head again.
"Thank God it didn't come to that," he says.
He explains that by the time the demonstrators really got going in Berlin, and it was later there than in Leipzig and elsewhere, Milke had already stood down. And he had been there so long the generals simply did not know how to give any orders on their own. They could not seize control.
"And this is what saved us," Bonsack says, shaking his large head. "Us and the people."
Somehow, back in September, it became clear to Herr Bonsack that the files would have to be destroyed. He told his bosses he was going to start shredding.
"It is not allowed," the boss said. "There is no order to do so." "But," Herr Bonsack says, "I just drove my car into the yard and got the files out of the filing cabinets. There were meters and meters of them. Agents' key files, films, reports, and I drove to our garden 100 kilometers away from Berlin."
The family had an old baker's oven on its holiday plot, and then,
"totally privately and personally, without any permission and without any command," he says, "I destroyed everything all day long."
There was so much paper to burn, the oven nearly collapsed. A cloud of black smoke hung over him in the sky. Herr Bonsack stood there for 3 days, feeding the files into the fire. The weak afternoon light is fading, and the publican comes in to turn on some lamps. He is a man of Herr Bonsack's age, with a ravaged face, red hands and a tea towel tucked into his apron.
"Everything all right here?" he asks.
Herr Bonsack orders another beer, another corn and a coffee. I say I'm fine for the moment. Herr Bonsack smiles gently at me.
"You know?"
he says.
"You are utterly without need?"
I glimpse beneath a genial drinker, a man who was the match of anyone, east or west. Herr Bonsack wanted to stop his files getting into the wrong hands. They concerned the Western agents he ran, West German citizens who did things for the Stasi.
"In my section," he says, "they were all journalists. We used them to start scandals or break open political cover-ups. We funded them and we fed them scoops."
The smoke attracted attention. Bonsack's neighbour in the country, he says, was a hopeless soak.
But of course even he had a suspicion about where I worked.
We call it the Stallgeruch, the smell of the sty. He used to lean over the fence and slur abuse at me, old shiny bum, and S.E.D., and all kinds of insults. He was there again, drunk as usual, while I was burning it all up, and as the smoke passed over his house, he began singing the anthem of the citizens' rights movement. Wir sind das Volk. He knew exactly what I was doing. It was grotesque, really, Bonsack chuckles. His aria to accompany my burning pyre.
I look at Herr Bonsack in all his clever dishevelment. A strand of his hair has left the rest and sticks out at an angle above his ear. He tilts his head back to drain his shot glass again. His neck is ringed and ridged, the Adam's apple moving up and down like a mouse on a ladder. Herr Bonsack looks around him.
Here,
he says,
I was always a regular. I had my spot at the bar. I've lived around the corner for 38 years. Before 1989, I was always just, Gunther, hello, how's it going? People didn't know what I did, but of course they had their suspicions. Sometimes I'd come straight from work with a tie and a stylish overcoat with a briefcase, and there'd be a rumble through the pub of, doesn't he look fine? They would have a sniff as much as to say something's not quite right here.
He pinches his nose between forefinger and thumb.
The wall fell on the 9th of November, 1989. The first time I came in here afterwards, I think it was the 15th.
He pauses, takes a drink and a breath.
A drunken man was at the front bar, and when he saw me, he swiveled around slowly, pointed at me and screamed, Stasi, out! Everyone shut up and turned to have a look at me. They all thought the same as he, or at least half of them. I couldn't move. I said to the publican, what do they want from me? I said, I can't stand here before you all and undo it, take it all back. After that, I sat down. I drank a beer and I just sat there.
He draws his lips into a line and holds his hands out as if to say, what could I do? Herr Bonsack kept coming back. It took nearly 3 years until no one was aggressive any more.
But there were no hangings or attempts or anything. In fact, I was relieved, really, that the people reacted so sensibly.
But the drinkers were not the only public. Herr Bonsack got wind that a magazine, Die Linke, had managed to obtain a disc containing the names of the top-paid 20,000 Stasi employees and was about to publish it. He knew everyone would read it, find his name and address on the list, and feel whatever they would feel, contempt, hatred, or self-righteousness. He knew there was only one thing for him to do.
I would out myself before I was outed.
He called Der Spiegel, the famous West German news magazine, and arranged to tell them everything.
I really pulled my pants down, as they say, he says. When I got the edition in my hand, I felt sick. There was a photo and everything. I mean, when you were silent and you lie for 26 years, and then all of a sudden you see yourself in a magazine, it was really...
He pauses again.
I have to say it was a bit strange for me here.
He pats his heart. Hardly any of his former colleagues will talk about what they used to do. It is almost a sort of omerta, a code of honour that rules them. He tells me that they still meet in groups according to rank or at birthdays and funerals. A general who remains on speaking terms with him told him that at a recent 70th birthday, proceedings were run like a divisional meeting from the old days. There was an agenda, and the men went through it item by item. It consisted mainly of passing around clippings or reporting on television programs against the Stasi. It was as if the old Stasi leaders here have now found a new enemy, the media. And Herr Bonsack is a traitor because he went to them with his story. After he outed himself, he got death threats over the phone.
You arsehole, how low can you go?
And these sorts of things, he says. The calls were anonymous, but sometimes he recognized the voice.
A general rang him up from a pub. He said, you motherfucker, that's enough, your time will come.
Then he started screaming, "Stop it! Stop it!" until people took him away from the phone.
The calls have stopped now.
I was never frightened, Bonsack says. I mean, I used to check my car to see if it had been tampered with, but there's not much point doing that, because if they're any good, they do it so as you can't tell.
I ask him who his friends are now.
Well, I have none,
he says, nodding to the publican for more. He looks at me with shiny, anaesthetized eyes.
I've fallen between two stools, you might say.
At 3 a.m. there's a phone call. This time it's not Klaus, it's home. They have found 4 tumours in my young mother's head, secondaries from a cancer we had all dared to hope was gone. She says on the phone,
"Je suis foutu, je suis foutu."
Later, what they did to her affected, for a time, her speech. And she, a woman of such elegant and slicing language. But at that moment only the French would do, and she knew she was foutu. Uwe is, unsurprisingly, all kindness. He helps me pack at the apartment, gathering up books and tapes and stray socks covered in dust. I am grateful for his sympathy, and more for the way he ignores, at the right moments, my distress.
"We'll take you to the airport if you like," he says.
"Thank you." All my reactions feel unreal, slow and underwater. "We?"
"Frederica and me. You know Frederica, from the Spanish translation section."
"Yes," I lie. I call Miriam, but I know that it's a formality. I'm not even hoping that I'll get a live voice on the line. "Hi, Miriam. I hope you're well. We seem to be missing each other a lot. My time here is up, and I'm going home." It strikes me suddenly as obscene to be saying that my time is up. I think of saying, "I'll be back," but that might be the last thing she wants to hear. The tape is rolling. It'll stretch my silence to an embarrassing length. I like to say something casual and ironic to cover things here, but my German doesn't reliably stretch to irony. I am forced to say things in a much more direct and heartfelt manner than I would in English. "Miriam, look after yourself," I say, "and good luck." The morning I leave, I try again and the phone rings out. The answering machine isn't even connected anymore. When they come to collect me, I do recognize Frederica. She is a beautiful Venezuelan with a mole at the corner of her mouth, and together she and Uwe are electric. He drives calmly to Tegel, solicitous of a world that has finally looked after him. It took 9 months for my mother to die, and each day except for the last 3, she was conscious. Conscious that the days were, as they say, numbered, and that the number was not a big one. And the feeling of being robbed of all the things you were going to do in the future, but seeing at the same time that they were not important, it was simply the future itself, a bigger number, that was. After she died, grief came down on me like a cage. It was another 18 months before I could focus on anything outside an immediate small area of sadness, or could imagine myself into anyone else's life. All up, it was nearly 3 years before I came back to Berlin. Chapter 25. Berlin, Spring 2000. Berlin is green, a perfumed city. I realize I have never been here in full spring. Even from my old nightly flying television excursions into summer, I could never have imagined this. The trees are huge and lush, light green. Sunlight filters through them, soft and scented over the pavements and parks, squares and schools and cemeteries. Outside my windows, the chestnuts are magical. They bear white flowers in upright stacks, candelabra produced by a trick of nature. Their heady sweetness floats in the air like the memory of kinder times. I contacted the rental agency. In a piece of freaky good luck, my old apartment had suddenly become available. It was about to be renovated, so the students had left. "Because of its pre-renovation condition," the agency wrote,
We make no assurances that the apartment is suitable or indeed livable. I'll take my chances, I thought. I bought stationery, bed linen, and a coffee maker, and moved in. I walk through it now, folding and unfolding a copy of the letter. I sent it from Australia to her old address. Dear Miriam, it is some time ago now, but you might remember we spent an afternoon and evening together. Afterwards, I tried to write your story, but I found I needed to explain other things around it, so the work took a course of its own. I wrote about the GDR and about the Stasi, and then I spoke with other people, some who had been followed by the Stasi and some who had worked for them. I was trying, I think, to get a perspective on this lost world and the kinds of courage in it. I'm coming back to Berlin and was wondering if we might meet again. I'd like to ask you whether you've got any further with the DA in Dresden and whether the puzzle women in Nuremberg have discovered any news about Charlie. I want to make sure, too, that I have everything right. I'm sorry I've been such a long time coming back to you. I've been working on this only on and off. I'm looking forward to summer in Berlin and perhaps to visiting Leipzig. No reply came, but the letter didn't return to me either. Before I left, I emailed Julia too. She wrote back in English. Hi, Anna. Good to hear from you. I'm in San Francisco. I left Berlin 8 months ago for the States. I was just living with too many things from my past that could come and find me there. I am doing great, as they say here. I'm working in a feminist bookshop near Berkeley and have made some friends. We went on a Reclaim the Night march recently, something that made me feel real positive and far away from Thuringen and everything that happened here. They honour their victims here. Really, everyone seems to have a story of something that happened to them. I'm sure it could go too far, but for me now, it is a good thing. I am foreign here and speak with an accent, but am much more at home than in my own country. Funny, no? If you're ever through San Fran, please let me know. Julia. The apartment has not much changed. Such a rock-bottom flat, it would have been hard to denude it further. In fact, it is the additions that are most noticeable. There is a line of postcards pinned up on the wall and over the ceiling of the living room. They suggest travel, but are souvenirs only of pub crawls through the city. They are the free ones with advertising on them. In the kitchen, there is a jar of scrawny but cheery dried lavender, and in the bedroom, a large drawing of a mushroom in magic marker has appeared on the wall. The mushroom has two cross-hatched windows on the cap for eyes and a door in the stem. It also has a wide smile on its face. The door is a big tooth. Because this mushroom head is also a penis, and it is coming all up the bedroom wall. The first morning I get up and take my coffee across the road to the park. It's very early but light already, an exquisite day. The sky is blue-white, the air still and new, and the streets are hushed. The park is a sweeping curve of green up to the cafe, shuttered over like eyelids. At the bottom lies the pond, which I knew before as a black and dead thing. Now water lilies float in it, opening up to touch the sun. Somewhere near, a small band of frogs ushers in the day. I sit on one of the benches and look up at the statue of Heine. I never spent time here before. The seats seemed always to be occupied. Instead of a poet's hands, the East German sculptor has given Heine big workman's paddles. The quote reads, "We don't catch hold of an idea, rather the idea catches hold of us and enslaves us and whips us into the arena so that we, forced to be gladiators, fight for it." Heine, the free-thinking poet, would be turning in his grave to see the sort of enslaving and forcing and fighting that has gone on here, under his cold black nose and pigeon-shit shoulders. Shapes catch my eye behind the statue. Two men are shuffling in, one from up the hill and one from the corner below, in suits and slippers, with tins of beer in their pockets. Another three appear and take their places on the benches. A couple of them carry cloth shopping bags full of cans. One is wearing a medal on a ribbon around his neck like a Lord Mayor. Once everyone is settled, am I in someone's place? They are leaving a whole bench for me. There are polite greetings and handshakes all round, and nods to me. It's as if we were in someone's living room. One old fellow kneels on his bench to face over the park. He takes out two slices of white bread and breaks them, with shaky hands, into even-sized pieces. Instead of throwing them, he lays out a pattern in crumbs on the concrete rampart behind the seat, each piece equidistant from the others. Some kind of madness, some kind of generosity. A man jogs past in yellow shorts and a bandana. The drunks greet him in a chorus of, "Morgan!
Morgan!"
he puffs back. These park men are the gatekeepers here, suited and track-suited sphinxes. Sparrows and pigeons start to fly in for the bread, and suddenly I understand my companion's ceremonial care. We are now the central focus of the park. Nature comes to us in small, winged genuflections at this altar of bread and beer. A latecomer walks up to the group in black training pants. His legs are stilts inside the synthetic material. He's slightly younger than the others, his hair dark and slicked back. He carries a sports bag full of beer.
"Harry, mate, long time no see,"
says the man with the medal. The medal rests on his bare belly. He is wearing a suit coat with no shirt and red braces over his skin to hold his pants up.
"I've been away."
"Where you been?"
"On holiday."
"You been on holiday? Mensch, I need a holiday. Where'd you go?"
"Mexico."
I feel a laugh forming, but the others are nodding solemnly.
"What you been doing over there, then?"
"Hunt him."
"Ah," the Lord Mayor nods. "Good hunting in Mexico."
"The best."
"What'd you hunt, then, in Mexico?"
"Elephants."
No one bats an eye.
"Any luck?"
"Nah."
Harry shakes his head, sits down and zips open his bag to get into the day's drinking. Perhaps this is really a society of poets and priests, where all stories are metaphorical. Or perhaps reality has been so strange here that anything else is welcome to take its place. The man with the medal turns to me and raises his can.
"Cheers,"
he says. "Cheers," I lift my mug.
"Healthier than beer,"
he grins. He is missing two front teeth.
"But not as much fun," I smile back.
He takes this as an invitation and comes to sit on my bench.
"You're not from around here,"
he says, reaching into his pocket for a tin of tobacco.
"No."
"You from Cologne?"
"No, I'm..."
"Let me guess, Hamburg?"
"No, I'm from Australia."
"Oh,"
he says. He leans into me and puts a large hand with curved brown fingernails on my knee.
"Don't worry about it," he breathes. "I too have impure blood."
I'm smiling, astonished. "How's that?"
"My mother was a Pole."
"Oh." He starts rolling a cigarette. His grey hair is brill-creamed into a neat duck's tail. His moustache is stained brown where he sucks the cigarette. When he puts it in his mouth, he can keep talking hands-free, the cigarette clinging mysteriously to his bottom lip.
"You like this park?"
he asks. "Yes, very much."
"This park is good, but you should come mushrooming with us sometime. That's the best."
"Really? Where'd you go?"
"We all get on the train, me and some of my friends there."
He gestures to the others who have been watching us intently but now turn quickly back to their business.
"We go out to the end of the line with our baskets and gather mushrooms. It's fantastic."
I'm wondering whether he's having me on, painting a picture of train-riding drunks springing sprightly through the forest with their baskets and beer, plucking dainty mushrooms as they go, waving at the elephants. But he's not.
"We get,"
and he lists the species,
"Steinpilzer, Pfifferlinger, Maronenpilzer, Butterpilzer, Sandpilzer, they are yellow underneath and spongy, Rotkäper, they look like Fliegenpilzer but aren't, and..."
Something I don't quite catch.
"But you mustn't take them, because those you can only eat once."
He laughs, throwing his head back, so I see an expanse of gum and ridged palate like an underwater thing.
"We get 4 kilos in each basket, and we come home and cook them up with a little butter. Superb!"
He waves a forefinger in front of me.
"You know,"
he says, bringing the finger to his chest,
When it comes to mushrooms, in that field, I am the professor.
Professor Mushroom's medal wobbles a little, blinking in the light on his stomach. A mumbled chorus of approval comes from the other benches. His friends raise their cans to him. I'm glad to be here. It strikes me as absurd to have never spoken with these men before, who have been, after all, my neighbours. He continues with some advice.
You've got to get outdoors, he says. You know, television is not good for the eyes, not healthy.
I wonder if he was somehow watching over me that winter, seeing the flickering black and white at my window. Maybe these men, stationed in parks and on street corners, at tram stops and in the underground, are the ones who see everything now. A woman walks past on her way to the lights, and he lifts his hand in greeting, or to let her pass.
Back in the GDR, I was a tailor. Now that's not good for the eyes either. I wanted to be an actor or a cook, but it didn't happen.
I think he has become both with this performance and his sautéed mushrooms.
Until 1990, I was in the voluntary fire brigade, but then it all went to hell in a handcart. This capitalismus, you can't imagine the sort of shit it's building.
He sniffs and spits onto the ground.